It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In a three-day hearing last week, the United Steelworkers made its case for adjunct professors who work at Duquesne University to collectively bargain with the school for better wages and working conditions. In 2012, a majority of adjunct professors at the university's McAnulty College of Liberal Arts voted to be represented by the Adjunct Faculty Association of the USW. But Duquesne has refused to recognize the AFA-USW, contending that its religious affiliation provides it with an exemption from federal law regarding collective bargaining. I'm joined now in Studio A by Dan Kovalik. He's the union's lead lawyer in the case. Dan, good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
Also joining us is Clint Benjamin, an adjunct English instructor at Duquesne and the Community College of Allegheny County. Clint Benjamin, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Again, the number 412-246-2002. We invited a representative of Duquesne University to be on this show with us. Our invitation was declined, but we have a statement from Duquesne President Charles Daugherty, which we will share with you momentarily. But first, gentlemen, we've been talking about this since 2012, when an overwhelming majority of adjunct professors at Duquesne, at the McAnulty College of Liberal Arts, voted to be represented by the Adjunct Faculty Association of the United Steelworkers Union, which is the Steelworkers Union of part-time faculty. And so why didn't this settle the issue that these instructors could collectively bargain with Duquesne for better wages and working conditions right then and there?
Well, Duquesne, which, by the way, had initially signed an election stipulation, that is, they initially consented to NRB jurisdiction, a few weeks after signing a contract saying that they would have an election, decided instead to raise this so-called religious exemption to NRB, National Labor Relations Board jurisdiction, trying to argue that somehow having to bargain with the union on behalf of the adjunct faculty would somehow impede their religious mission at the university.
But they submitted to originally they agreed to the process of arbitration?
To representation. They actually consented to a mail ballot election.
Oh, I beg your pardon. So they agreed that these instructors could organize, that they could be represented by a union, and that the university would negotiate with the union.
Indeed. In fact, when we went to Duquesne in May of 2012, and we said, look, we have a majority of adjuncts have signed union representation cards. Why don't you just voluntarily recognize us? Let's even forget about the NRB. Just voluntarily recognize us and bargain with us. It was Duquesne who said, no, we want you to go to the NRB, file a petition. Let's do it that way. We filed a petition. They agreed to a stipulation, to a mail ballot election. Everything seemed great. And about 3 weeks later, they fired their local attorney here, hired a new attorney from outside, a union buster from Memphis. And they argued for the first time, oh, while we said you had jurisdiction, NRB, you don't, and we're going to fight this.
And Clint Benjamin, what is it that the adjuncts want from Duquesne that they're not getting now?
I think it's just a simple there's the big three, I think, of perhaps better pay, more job security, and perhaps benefits. But, you know, dignity and respect is probably the overarching umbrella thing we're looking for.
Well, what does dignity go for these days? At what price?
You've got me on that one, but it's certainly not what we're getting.
Dan, you say initially Duquesne officials said the institution would recognize the union. Shortly afterward, the school changed its mind, and you mentioned they brought in a union-busting attorney. Did they give any other reason for doing this other than that based on what you're saying and what the university is saying, that they had this epiphany that, wait a minute, we are exempt from this. We don't have to go along with the federal rules on collective bargaining, federal laws on collective bargaining.
Yeah, they never have explained that. I mean, as I once quipped, they signed this stipulation and 3 weeks later say, oh, we forgot we're Catholic. it'll never be known exactly what happened, but clearly they have, by the way, four other unions on campus. They bargain with other unions. Those are all certified by the NLRB. And they told us this initially, and that's why they said they'd recognize us if we were elected the representative. You know, so that was their modus operandi. They were used to bargaining with unions, and I think someone put a bug in their ear at some point shortly after signing the stipulation that there was a movement afoot among some Catholic universities to resist unionization on this basis, and they decided to go along with that. But I must say, not all the Catholic universities are doing that. Georgetown University, pretty darn good Catholic university, voluntarily recognized the SEIU as the union for their adjuncts. San Francisco University, which is also Catholic, did the same thing. So not all the Catholic schools are lined up on this, but there are several schools that are opposing unionization on these grounds. And again, Duquesne, I think because of Charles Daugherty's own kind of political, I mean, in my view, kind of right-wing political leanings, decided to go along with those other universities.
So, Clint, where do the adjuncts stand with this? How frustrated are they?
Well, I can only really, I think, speak for myself, but I would say it's frustration level midnight for me. This has been 3 years of bickering. We've numerous times said, hey, we don't even need the NLRB. We can bargain outside the NLRB, which I think is an eminently reasonable position. Duquesne has said no time and time again. They move the goalposts constantly. It's aggravating.
Here is the statement from President Charles Daugherty on the situation, why Duquesne University is taking the position that they are taking. Quoting Charles Daugherty, quote, first and foremost, it is important to recognize that this case is not about the rights of working men and women to organize. Duquesne is committed to the church's concern that the dignity of working men and women be respected and that they have fair pay and safe working conditions. This case is about Duquesne's protection under the First Amendment from an unconstitutional intrusion of government control over us as a religious institution. The fact that the steelworkers say that Duquesne's effort to protect that right is not about God or religion fully demonstrates their complete lack of understanding and denial of this university's religious mission and identity. We are not the first school to be threatened with the infringement of our religious freedom. Dan Kovalik, what about this? Is this about religious freedom?
Well, no. In fact, both Clint and Charles Daugherty have mentioned this issue of the dignity of labor. And I did actually wanted to quote back to Charles Daugherty and Duquesne a quote from the pastoral letter on Catholic social teaching put out by the U.S. Bishops Conference. They say unequivocally, quote, no one may deny the right to organize without attacking human dignity itself, unquote. The Catholic Church is very clear that they respect the rights of working people to organize, and that is an unconditional right. Charles Daugherty and Duquesne cannot answer that concern. They have no basis under their own Catholic faith that they claim to follow. They have no basis for objecting to unionization on campus amongst these adjuncts. And what I will say, too, by the way, we are not a threat to their religious mission at all. But I want to say that if they believe and they act like, frankly, we're some sort of existential threat to their religious mission, if they actually believe that, to me, frankly, they betray a brittleness in their own faith, that we could somehow are a threat to that institution, shows how little faith they have in their own faith and that institution. And it's rather sad. You know, the only threat to their religious mission this case poses comes from them by denying our right, not just legal right, our moral right under their own Catholic social teaching to organize.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the issue of adjunct instructors trying to get better wages and working conditions at Duquesne University. They have organized and voted in favor of union representative with the United Steelworkers Union. to have union representation. And there was a three-day hearing last week as the USW made its case for the adjunct professors who work at Duquesne University to collectively bargain, something that Duquesne has refused to do at this point. Dan Kovalik is the union's lead lawyer in the case. Also with us is Clint Benjamin, an adjunct English instructor at Duquesne and CCAC. And we did invite a representative of the university, Charles Doherty or whomever, to join us. And our invitation was declined. 412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Let's go to Joe in the North Hills. Joe, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good afternoon, Paul. Dan and Clint, I went to parochial school for 12 years, and I got drilled in me this whole matter about social teaching and that, and unionization, and so on and so forth. I'm just curious. This sounds to me to be as hypocritical as possible. Every time I read about it in the USW magazine, it makes me really want to shriek. What do the students, you know, who pay top dollar to attend this institution and their parents, what do they have to say about this? Have they protested on your behalf or anything?
That's an interesting question, Joe. Glad you brought that up. What about that? Have we heard from this? Where do the students stand on this?
Well, first of all, Joe, I couldn't agree more that their position is hypocritical. I think that is indeed the word. I'm also a product of Catholic school education from second grade through college, and I am also very aware of Catholic social teaching. I would actually have to ask Clint, who works at Duquesne, what is the student reaction to all this?
I think the students are generally, once they're abridged of it, they are, you know, properly outraged. The students, of course, have their own, you know, concerns and interests. You can't really tell that an adjunct is an adjunct unless they come clean, right? I mean, professors are a scruffy group by and large anyway. But once they're informed of it, generally, I'd say 9 out of 10 have been supportive. And it really is. Not only is it an adjunct issue about the professors, but it's a student issue as well. When professors are struggling to eat or make rent, obviously that's going to impact the quality of education they're going to get. And that's one of the motivations of us forming this union, is to improve our conditions, have a voice, have a say at the table.
Joe, thank you for that call. 412-246-2002. Let's go to Charlie in Pittsburgh. Charlie, welcome. You're on the air. And I think we might have lost Charlie. He did want to ask about, I understand from what I'm seeing on the screen, that he doesn't understand how religious affiliations can get away morally and ethically with disregarding the federal law. Are, in fact, universities like Duquesne protected under the First Amendment from federal law regarding collective bargaining? They're saying that by being forced to submit to this law, collective bargaining, that this infringes on their religious rights and therefore their First Amendment rights.
Yes. We, under a new decision issued by the NLRB called Pacific Lutheran, we are confident that they have no such right. Moreover, we don't see how the First Amendment is even implicated here. The Supreme Court did, in a 1978 case called Catholic Bishops, they did find that Catholic parochial schools in Chicago had a First Amendment right to be exempt from the NLRB. But what they made clear is the reason was because these parochial Catholic schools, grade schools, high schools, existed to proselytize and to inculcate the Catholic faith. Duquesne made it clear at the hearing that is not what they do there. You can be a Muslim and go to Duquesne. You can be Jewish and go to Duquesne. In fact, if you look at their website, all their materials, they encourage diversity. And they make it clear they do not want their instructors proselytizing. That is not the goal of Duquesne. And why isn't it? Because no one would go to the school. You know, they want people to go to the school of all backgrounds. And so they make it clear that is not what they do. So I think it's an abuse to try to use the First Amendment to resist unionization in a case like this.
So the case involving Pacific Lutheran, from a judicial standpoint, the effect of this or the impact of the decision in that case creates a new set of exemption criteria?
Yes.
And again, just to clarify that, it's that unless you have the specific mission of imparting a particular faith, as these parochial schools in Chicago, the case that you mentioned, do, that anything short of that does not provide a set of criteria under which you can say we are exempt because of our religious mission.
Yes, I think that is a fair characterization. Essentially, what the board says, unless the school holds out the particular faculty involved, the adjunct faculty involved here, as having a special responsibility to carry on the religious mission, they cannot get the benefit of that exemption. Again, after the three-day hearing, it was very clear the adjuncts are not held out in any such way. Again, on the stand, Duquesne admitted you could be an atheist and teach at Duquesne. You could be Muslim and teach at Duquesne. And they're not going to tell you if you're an atheist you have to teach Catholicism or Christianity or any particular religion. So we think under Pacific Lutheran and under Catholic bishops, again, that they don't have a prayer, if you allow me to say, of winning this case.
Let's go to Jane in the North Hills. Jane, you're on Central Pittsburgh. Welcome. Hi, Jane. Let's try AJ and Crafton. AJ, are you there? Okay. We have apparently we have a couple people on the phone, and I'll try Jane again. Jane?
Yes. Hello?
Hi, Jane in the North Hills. How are you?
Good. And yourself?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
I think it is somewhat hypocritical of Duquesne University after the way that Mary Jo Vodko, who taught there for several decades, was treated as an adjunct professor. And that certainly made local news widely a couple of years ago.
National news, actually. NPR did a story about her, and I was wondering when someone was going to bring that up. But that...
I think for them to stand on this religious and moral high ground after the way that dear old woman was treated after decades of service is shameful.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, Jane. And Dan Kovalik, I mean, in many ways, this woman has become the poster child for this issue. And if you can just, I think many people are familiar with the story of, I believe it's Margaret Mary Voitko. But just sum it up for us and how this really strikes at the heart of the issue that the adjuncts are fighting, the benefits that the adjuncts are fighting for.
Yes. Well, Margaret Mary Voitko worked for Duquesne University for 25 years. She taught French there. And near the end of her life, she was barely able to eke out a living on the wages she was being paid. She had serious health care issues. She was not, like all adjuncts, she does not get health care. She did not get health care from Duquesne. She had cancer. She was going into debt to the hospitals. Long and short of it is, she was a person in real need. And because of the way they treat adjuncts there, after working a lifetime at Duquesne, she had little to nothing to show for that. In the end, she was fired from Duquesne at the age of 83. She came to me personally to ask to file a discrimination case against Duquesne, which I did, and that case is still pending.
And in fairness to Duquesne, they kept her on for quite some time. And, you know, I don't know the specifics of where she was physically and mentally at, you know, by the time she reached her 80s and how effective she was as a teacher. But people at Duquesne will tell you that they tried to work with her and to help her. So is it fair to say that Duquesne simply booted her out the door?
Well, again, I'd like to quote from the pastoral letter on Catholic social teaching, which I have ready here. And they state that, but justice, not charity, demands certain minimum guarantees for workers, okay? It is true that Duquesne and some at least members of Duquesne did do some charitable acts for her, and I don't want to minimize that. But the fact is they did not pay her or give her the proper benefits over time to allow her at the age of 83 to leave that job with some sort of dignity and some way to support herself. And that is what they should feel ashamed of.
Let's go to Tracy in Beaver County. Tracy, welcome. You are not there, apparently. So let's go to Charlie in Pittsburgh. Charlie, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Charlie. You're on the air with Dan Kovalik and Clint Benjamin.
I was just calling because I have a long history of both with Catholic social teaching and, of course, Charles Owen Rice, who was one of the most famous of all of Duquesne's graduates. But it's really hard to understand. And I've, since the beginning of the story, I've had a very hard time understanding it because I think the position of adjuncts in higher education is something that really cries out for some kind of ethical and moral response. Very low wages, often without any medical insurance coverage. And these are young people who come out of university getting a higher level degree and have huge student debt to confront. And so their position, I think, is clearly a situation that, you know, cries out for some sort of redress. And Catholic social teaching is absolutely clear on it. 120 years of social teaching going back to 1892 in Rerum Novarum. And John Paul II was extremely strong on this issue of the right to organize and collectively bargain and to have representation. It's just very hard, I think, for many Catholics in the Pittsburgh region to understand Duquesne's position on this.
Well, Charlie, appreciate those comments. And one question I would ask you is that has Duquesne proposed any other way to resolve this? Dan Kovalik, has Duquesne come up with any other solution if they're not willing to go along with collective bargaining? Then what have they come back to you with?
Yes, they have come back with nothing. In fact, it is us that have tried to be creative in offering alternative solutions. We sent a letter to Duquesne, I believe it was October 2013, and said, look, if you don't want to be subject to the NORB, fine. We don't care. Just voluntarily recognize us, and we'll create a structure outside the NORB, a private resolution structure, so that we can get our demands met, so you can bargain with us, but not have, you know, if you see the NORB is somehow representing government interference, you won't have that interference. And they just wrote back and said no. You know, they have not tried to work with us. We are willing, and I say this now to Duquesne over the air, we're willing to work with you outside the NORB. We think you have a moral obligation and a legal obligation to bargain with us, and we will do that outside the NORB if that makes you more comfortable.
Let's take one last call from Sarah in Pittsburgh, who has a point to share with us. Go ahead, Sarah.
I have a spouse who is a tenure faculty member at an institution here in town. But through the different – being at different universities, we found that this problem is just far greater than even this just here, and that it is almost akin to what Walmart has been going through, using part-time employees to fill in what – originally was a good idea to fill in maybe some gaps, but then it turns into they're actually filling the places of people who really should be full-time people. And we've had friends that have been adjuncts at several different schools that they're just, you know, they don't even know if they've got a job until weeks before the semester starts. And that simply can't be good for students who are paying. You know, what are students paying now? Upwards of $40,000 a year. It just doesn't seem like it's a good solution, but it seems very similar to one that even if you're not in the academic world, everyone's familiar with what Walmart has been through and their trials with balancing part-time and full-time employees.
Well, you speak to a couple of issues, and one, I mean, Clint Benjamin was nodding in recognition. I mean, if at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is to serve students and to sharpen and feed young minds of the future, that this is not from forget about what is best for the instructors. Is this best for the students? And what Sarah is saying is that it does not seem to be.
Well, it certainly isn't. We've seen and Sarah's wise to bring this up. It's a Walmartization of education. It's a microcosm of jobs. and where they're going as a whole.
Right. That companies can save money by hiring part-time people, which therefore allows them to limit the benefits they pay. The legacy costs become less. And that seems to be how we're doing business in much of America these days.
Exactly. And as much as I'd like to think I'm a teaching dynamo, these things wear you down. I've been doing this for 7 or 8 years now, and it's tough. I have to fly to another campus when my classes are done. It impacts not just me, but all of my colleagues.
Your preparation, time management, all of that. All right, I lied. That was not our last call. This is our last call. Steve from Aetna. Oh, Steve. Steve probably heard what I said and said I can't hang around. But he did want to make a point about whether Duquesne's position benefits students financially or does it hurt students? And I think you probably just answered that question.
Yeah. Well, again, we believe. Truthfully, what we're doing, we're trying to save the university. The university, as Clint said very well, has been Walmartized, or Salon.com just had an article saying it's been turned into McDonald's. This type of situation is not good for anyone. We want to have faculty, all of whom will have job security, not be hired semester to semester like these folks are. Will have decent wages so that they will be able to make ends meet, be able to stay at that university and teach their students in a way that helps the students. So we think we're helping them.
And we were talking off the air. I was asking you before we did the show where you see this case going, and it sounds like it's going to be a while potentially before it's going to be resolved. We have just a few seconds left, but what's potentially out there?
It could be a few years, because they can go to the NLRB in Washington after this. They can go to the courts. Who knows? One of these cases may go to the Supreme Court. And, of course, we fear that justice delayed is justice denied, and that they are trying to run out the clock.
Dan Kovalik is the lead lawyer for the United Steelworkers in the case for adjunct faculty against Duquesne University for the right to collectively bargain with the school for better wages and working conditions. We've had Clint Benjamin, an adjunct English instructor at Duquesne and the Community College of Allegheny County, with us as well. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks.
An invitation was extended to Duquesne University to have a representative join us for this conversation. That invitation was declined. Coming up, remembering the Pennsylvanians who died on the Lusitania, which sank 100 years ago today. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It was 100 years ago today, on May 7th, 1915, that a German U-boat sank the RMS Lusitania, a British passenger ship. Of the 1,198 who died, 128 were Americans, many with Pittsburgh connections. Germany was at war with England, but the United States had not yet entered what was known at the time as the Great War. Post-Gazette reporter Len Barkowski recently recounted the tragedy in a 100th anniversary piece for the Post-Gazette, and he joins us to talk about how the horror of the event hit southwestern Pennsylvania. Len Barkowski, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thank you very much, Paul.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. What have you looked into, Len, that's especially fascinating? The story hit home for readers of the newspapers, the main media, which covered the event, the Gazette Times and the Pittsburgh Press, and all of the misinformation, including a United Press bulletin that appeared in the late edition of the Press on the afternoon of May 7th, 1915, saying all the passengers were saved.
Wow, just bad timing and unconfirmed information. And the press ran it only as a single line, but they did indeed run it, and it indicated that there had indeed been an attack on the Lusitania, but that everyone had been rescued. Well, that story didn't hold up very long. The next morning's Pittsburgh Gazette Times had a much fuller report, and it gave some indication of the scope, the breadth of the tragedy. And at that point, we also started getting information here in Pittsburgh, because there were cables to bring this information across the ocean quickly. We started getting information about the likely loss of life among people with Pittsburgh connections or people who lived in Pittsburgh.
And before we get to that, how does this incident tie in with World War I?
The war had been underway for less than a year at that point. What both sides, and boy, this always seems to be the way wars start, what both sides believed would be a quick, decisive war, similar to the kind of conflicts that had been happened in other places during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The belief was that the war would be over quickly. That wasn't happening. There was stalemate in the West, and economic warfare became very, very important. The British had a huge navy, and they were able to effectively blockade much of Germany. That is, cutting off all sorts of imports that were critical to the German economy. The Germans, having a much smaller navy, they responded with submarine warfare, and that brought a new, even more brutal dimension to the war. Because in a lot of cases, submarines were relatively vulnerable, but undersea they could attack ships.
I think you pointed this out in your piece, that didn't the captain of the Lusitania say, we have a way of avoiding those submarines, even though basically there was no way he could know where they were?
The Lusitania was a very, very fast ship. There was arrogance in the sinking of the Titanic 2 years earlier, a ship that was unsinkable.
Lusitania bears a striking resemblance to the Titanic, with those four big boiler stacks, the smokestacks protruding upward out of the ship.
It does indeed, and it also bears, I think, some resemblance in the arrogance of the captain. The Titanic unsinkable, the Lusitania so fast that it would be able to get out in front of any submarine.
What had occurred prior to the sinking of the Lusitania that makes this a dangerous voyage?
The Germans had warned that a ship in what they saw as hostile territory, that is, British controlled waters, could be subject to sinking, that they were going to sink it. And they put announcements in New York newspapers saying this was going to happen. And that was enough, at least, for the uncle of Margaret Anderson, one of the Pittsburghers who was on the Lusitania. He saw those warnings, and he decided not to take the Lusitania back to Ireland and to England.
And who were the people with Pittsburgh connections on board?
There were a good number of people. Maybe the saddest story involves Margaret Anderson. She was a young Northside bride. She and her husband had been married for about a year. She was returning to her home in Ireland. And she had gotten a traveling companion, another Northsider named Margaret Kelly. They both booked passage on the Lusitania, and they had staterooms next to each other, second-class passengers. George Anderson, Margaret's husband, could not get any information for 48 hours. Again, this was a huge loss of life. The number of passengers who died, clearly a large number, but the identities of them were not immediately clear. 48 hours without word, a telegram from Anderson's father-in-law, Margaret's dad, saying we've had no information yet. Some good news for another family from Vandergriff, the Tierneys. Mr. Tierney got word that his wife and his daughter were both safe. Over the next couple of days, the news got better and the news got worse. George Anderson did get a telegram saying that his wife Margaret was safe from his father-in-law, and the Gazette Times then reported that Mr. Anderson decided he would then be able to go ahead with the house that he and his wife had planned, their new home for their new marriage. That happiness did not last. The next day, there was another telegram from Margaret Anderson's dad saying, "Margaret lost. Deepest sympathies." It had been a terrible experience for George Anderson. And I think 100 years later, the pain, the lack of knowledge, the false hope, it still echoes with us.
Why was there so much misinformation?
Again, it was such a chaotic scene. The ship sank in about 18 minutes. People were caught completely unexpected.
And again, it was a torpedo.
It was a torpedo. Single torpedo did great damage to the boat. It sank quickly. There would have been people who would have been killed instantly by the blast. In Eric Larson's book, there's a new book out about the Titanic. Apparently, it blew a hole in the side of the ship the size of a house. I mean, it was a massive explosion. Many people would have been killed by that massive explosion. Others would have been thrust into the water with no sort of identification, just the clothes they were wearing. And then, of course, there was a confusion. And in this moment, there was another Pittsburgher named Killaway, who we got no information on her, but it turns out that there was another person with a very similar name on the boat. So it was, but it probably took 2 or 3 days before it was able to be determined that Miss Killaway, under another name, had survived the sinking of the Lusitania.
We're talking with Post-Gazette reporter Len Barkowski about the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania. It happened 100 years ago today, May 7th, 1915. Now, certainly the Germans have been, and rightly so, been vilified for what they did. But did the Lusitania, in fact, contain weapons that the U.S. was sending to England? 4 million U.S.-made rifle bullets and other munitions that the ship was carrying from neutral America to wartime Britain.
Boy, history, you know, the history really is not the past, is it? I mean, the disputes, the discussions continue. There does seem to be evidence now that there were indeed war materials on the Lusitania.
And they can confirm this because the ship is what? Where is the Lusitania? Because the evidence is presumably there.
It's about 10 miles off the coast of Ireland, 10, 12 miles off the coast of Ireland. The salvage rights have been sold, but most of the ship still remains under the ocean. I am not certain if there's a definitive word on what precisely was being carried and how much those armaments claimed to be on the ship, what role they may have played in the quick sinking of the Lusitania.
The British thought that it would draw the United States into the war. How much did the British government and people like Winston Churchill, who at that time was Britain's first Lord of the Admiralty, know about the possibility that a ship like this would be attacked and perhaps hope it would be attacked?
I don't know that there's any definitive evidence on this. I'll go back to the arrogance of the Cunard line and of the ship's captain. The belief was that this ship was going to be able to go so fast that submarines were not going to be able to keep up with it.
But again, you'd have to know where the submarines were, right?
And the British certainly immediately took advantage of this public relations disaster for the Germans in encouraging outrage against the Kaiser's government for this attack. President Woodrow Wilson stood firm, though, against the idea of going to war here. He made a fairly famous speech in which he used the phrase "too proud to fight." And he drew an awful lot of criticism from a good number of people, including Teddy Roosevelt, who to some extent never saw a war he didn't like. But Wilson held firm and kept the country out of war. And as a matter of fact, when he ran for re-election in 1916, he campaigned in part on the slogan "He kept us out of war." Nevertheless, the Germans did eventually reinstitute unrestricted submarine warfare. Wilson was inaugurated for his second term, and within a month, he had asked for a declaration of war, and Congress gave him a declaration of war against Germany. And then in 1917, the United States entered the First World War, and pretty much tip the tide
right.
in favor of the Allies.
We have just less than 30 seconds left. Is anything happening in Pittsburgh today with such a Pittsburgh connection to that tragedy of the Lusitania? Is there any sort of commemoration of the event happening?
None that I'm aware of. A little surprising, but again, we're still finishing up kind of the ends of the Civil War. World War I tends to be ignored.
Well, we didn't ignore it here, certainly. Len Barkowski is a Post-Gazette writer and historian joining us to talk about the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania. It happened today, on this day, I should say, in 1915. Len Barkowski, as always, great thanks.
Thanks. Good being here.
Coming up, travel contributor Elaine LaBalme has summer destinations for theatergoers. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For theatergoers, one of the joys of the upcoming summer season will be seeing plays performed on the Straw Hat Circuit, as it's called. From old-time musicals to a bit of the Bard, there's no shortage of theaters where people will be treading the boards. Elaine LaBalme, who always brings down the house and tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, joins us this week with summer theater recommendations. Elaine, is always good to see you.
No pressure with that introduction, Paul.
I'm sorry, you know, but I know you can handle it.
I'll do what I can.
Okay, New Girl, you're tripping the light fantastic this week as you take us on a tour of summer theaters and festivals in the region. Who is the target audience for this kind of getaway?
You know, I would say most everyone. There are so many possibilities, so many different kinds of festivals and, you know, longstanding theaters, repertory companies that just do a great job. You have to look for something that appeals to you. For example, you know, Shakespeare may not really be the thing for younger kids and families as a rule. But musicals, say, I mean, they enjoy wide appeal, even if you can't follow every little bit. Kids are, you know, we took our son to musicals starting at the age of four, and he enjoyed it, even if he didn't get every little subtlety. So you have to pick and choose. What I do like about the summer theater and festival circuit is that it's smaller, it's more accessible. So many of the festivals around today, you think, oh, Coachella, you know, South by Southwest, they've just gotten so big that they're really hard to manage. These summer theaters and festivals are very accessible, much more personal, relatable,
outdoors.
Just easier outdoor. So, hey, can you imagine if it was a day like today? Just a beautiful day to be outside. So, there's lots of positive things about them, and lots of options in the area.
Yeah, and really a lot of the. I mean, right now it's pretty warm out, but you know, by evening, when the sun goes down, it's nice to be outside. You bring your bug spray and a lawn chair, and there you go.
And
right?
You are ready. Absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
So once again, you've graced us with a Fab Five list of summer theater options. And first up is the Finger Lakes Musical Theater Festival in upstate New York.
Yes, a beautiful area to be in the summer. This is in Auburn, New York. And this festival, I mean, this year they've got everything from West Side Story to Saturday Night Fever on tap. So it really runs the gamut. They do their performances in three different venues. The one that's best known is the Merry-Go-Round Playhouse, about 500 seats. So you can see right away it's a somewhat more intimate venue. And the area just has so much to offer. Lots of great bed and breakfasts in the region. The wineries of the Finger Lakes region are very popular. So you can make a nice long weekend out of it. Get your theater fix, good food, wine, you know, yet another reason to take you up to the Finger Lakes region.
And the Stratford Festival in Ontario performs the classics alongside world premieres.
Yes. And well, let me just say, first of all, this, even if it is in Ontario, it's not as far as you might think. It's, you know, it's a roughly 5-hour drive from Pittsburgh. It's in southwestern Ontario. So you can leave in the morning. You're there by lunchtime.
You need a passport, though, right?
You do, in fact.
You used to not need that to go to Canada.
Several years ago, you did not. But now in recent times, you have. So plan ahead a little bit so that you can get there. And you will appreciate this, Paul, because I do believe you've done some theater. But they use a thrust stage for their performances.
Yes.
You know,
We've been celebrating centennials. Yesterday was Orson Welles's what would have been his 100th birthday, and he was the guy who championed the thrust stage.
Yes, well, as did Shakespeare, of course, too. The Globe Theater was the thrust stage, but this suggests a stage that is open on three sides, so the audience is just much closer and much more involved with the performance. And actually, the Stratford Festival was one who brought back the thrust stage, oh, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago. They had fallen out of favor, and then they built one, and after that, more theaters in North America built them. So not only do they use that for their Shakespeare performances, but some other performances. And I mean, this year they're, you know, they're doing Hamlet, but they're also doing The Sound of Music. So again, it runs the gamut. They have a premiere this year called The Last Wife, and it's on Catherine Parr, Henry VIII's sixth and final wife, the one who survived him happily. Most of the rest of them did not meet with a good outcome there. But
one or two beheadings.
Two or three, right? Yeah, yeah, that did not work out.
I lost track.
That was not a good gig to be the wife of Henry VIII.
No.
But again, another festival that has small venues, anywhere from 250 seats to 2,000 seats. So something for everyone.
The Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival takes on the Bard on the campus of DeSales University in the Lehigh Valley.
Yes, and this is a neat sort of a smaller festival. This year they'll do Henry V. They'll do Les Mis. And actually, they do a lot of performances that are good for audiences 8 and over. So this is a good one to bring the family to. They also have a program that they call Shakespeare for Kids. That'll run 2 weeks this summer, July 22nd through August 1st. It's a 60-minute show, and we can acquaint the little ones with, you know, the beauty of the Bard, which is a good thing. But, you know, if they don't want to go Shakespeare, they can do Rapunzel by Grimm. So they got something for everyone there, too. And this is in the Lehigh Valley, close to the Allentown, Bethlehem area. So you're maybe an hour from Philly. What I like about it is that you can do some theater there and then also combine it with that urban experience in Philadelphia.
We're talking with our travel contributor, Elaine LaBaume, about summer theater destinations, places you might want to travel to check out summer theater, much of which happens outdoors and often is a lot of fun. The Weather Vane Playhouse near Columbus, Ohio, you say it keeps it light and it makes for a great overnight playcation. This is a new word you've come
up
with.
There you go. We go from staycation to playcation. I'm liking the playcation thing, Paul. This group, they do five productions every season. They start Memorial Day and every play runs 2 weeks. They're doing Rent this year. They're doing Dial M for Murder. So again, more modern stuff, more traditional. And their theater was originally this large barn near Columbus, Ohio. It was around for about 100 years and burned to the ground in a fire in 1976. They rebuilt it. 10 years later, burns to the ground again, rebuilt it, and it's still standing today. So props for that. But again, it's maybe 30, 40 minutes outside of Columbus, Ohio, which we recently talked about on a segment. There's so much good food and other things going on in Columbus that, again, you can do the theater experience there. Use Columbus as your toehold for a nice long weekend.
And if you're looking for something to augment that city staycation, you say look no further than the Pittsburgh Civic Light Opera.
Yes, and I love the Pittsburgh CLO. They do so much good stuff in the summertime. We try to catch one, two performances every year. They're doing The Wedding Singer this year, which is a great fun show. They're doing Kinky Boots, Cyndi Lauper's show from Broadway, even Cinderella. So a lot of classic musicals, and they just do a great job with them. Mary Poppins is on tap from June 19th through the 21st. A lot of the shows of the CLO are at the Benedum, so a lovely venue. So think about that night on the town in downtown Pittsburgh. Let's support our own urban experience and get the theater fix and still get to sleep at home in your own bed. The ultimate staycation.
Exactly. And yeah, the CLO, they used to do those shows at the Civic Arena with the open roof.
Whoa, that predates me, but that sounds great.
Yeah, that's what they I learned. I always thought it was built for hockey, but then when they tore it down, it said, you know, they built this for the CLO. And then they opened the roof. That's why they had the cantilever
right
roof. And then the first time they did that, all the sheet music blew all over the place.
Oh,
so it made it kind of tough. But, you know, but they found a new home, and you can still go see the CLO.
Absolutely. So. And they're better than ever.
Elaine LaBaume, she's better than ever. She's our travel contributor. She joins us each week at this time with her travel destinations, and it's summer, so she's got a lot of good ideas for you in the coming weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Elaine, as always, thank you, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the weeks ahead.
Thank you, Paul.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, go to our website at WESA.FM. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.